Thank you very much, Sweeney and Ellen, for these extremely kind words of introduction. The Institute of Theoretical Physics has done me a great honor in inviting me to present the George Batchelor Memorial Lecture. George, as has been said, was my thesis advisor, or as we would say in England, research supervisor, from 1958 to 1962 on the subject magnetohydrodynamic turbulence, the very subject that lies at the heart of our discussions in the program now running here on the physics of astrophysical turbulence. And so it seems peculiarly appropriate that I take this opportunity to recall George Batchelor's impact on the subject and the way we looked at it 40 years ago. It is all the more appropriate because since arriving here 2 weeks ago, I've learned that many of the issues we addressed then are still very much alive and kicking today. I have another picture of George, perhaps I'll use the larger projector. This picture of George was taken in 1983 when he gave the Prince lectures at Arizona State University. He was still then at the height of his intellectual powers. This was, in fact, the year when he retired from his professorship at Cambridge. There was a certain pressure to professors at that time to take retirement a few years before they needed to, and George accepted the offer that was made to him. I think that's why he's looking quite happy in this photograph. He was, from this point on, relieved of many of his teaching and administrative burdens. He did not, however, relinquish his editorship of JFM, the journal that he had founded in 1956. He devoted even more of his time and energy to the journal during the years that followed. In a single lecture about George, I will have to be very selective, and it's perhaps natural that I should focus on what I see as some of the highlights of his research, career, and particularly those that impinged on me personally. I don't want, however, to give the impression that this is in any way an adequate coverage. So let me start by showing you the first and last pages of his publications. There were about 90 papers in all, of which I can refer to no more than about half a dozen. So you will see how over-selective I have had to be. This is the first page of the list of publications of George. You see they started in 1944. He was still in Australia at the time. It was just before his journey to Cambridge that I'll tell you about in a moment. And he published several papers of a fairly practical nature at that time. But if you run down this list, you'll see one that I will want to comment particularly on right at the end of this first page, Kolmogorov's Theory of Locally Isotropic Turbulence, published in 1947, which I think was really the paper that put George very much on the map as a rising star in the field of turbulence research. I'm just wanting to give you this sort of impression. This is actually the second last page of his list of publications, page 8, and I show you that there are some. You see this is now 1987, 88, 89, 90. He comes back, interestingly, here to a contribution to the obituary of Kolmogorov. It's very much a central part of George Batchelor's life, his interaction with the theory of Kolmogorov, and he was invited to contribute to that obituary. They were commenting particularly on Kolmogorov's work on turbulence. And I want to draw your attention to this last paper on this page, A Homogeneous Buoyancy-Driven Turbulence with Canuto and Chasnov, published in 1992. So although that was JFM, volume 235, although George actually, his career was very much research-wise divided into two parts. There was the turbulence phase, which peaked in the 1950s and which really came to an end about 1961, as I will describe. But he came back to it with one or two very significant papers later on, and this one in 1992 was the last paper that George wrote in Turbulence. The other very important phase of his career started around 1970 with his work on suspension mechanics and microhydrodynamics, subject that he more or less created and had developed a new school of work in that area in Cambridge. And I won't be talking at all about that. I think it will be for others to assess George's impact in that area. The elements or the essentials of George's career I've indicated here, sort of abbreviated curriculum vitae, if you like. From November 1940 to December 1944, he was employed as a research officer. This was the war years, of course, at the CSIR Division of Aeronautics in Melbourne. From 46 to 48, he was a research student with a studentship from the Royal Commission for Exhibition of 1851 in Cambridge under the supervision of G.I. Taylor. In 1947, he was elected a Research Fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge. We call that a fellowship under Title A, Research Fellowship. And from 1951 until his death in 2000, he remained a Fellow of Trinity College under various other titles, B, D, and E. Nearly all the titles, these titles for fellowships in Trinity College are often described in the following way, that research fellowship, title A, is for promise in research, for great obvious talent. And title B is a senior research fellowship. It's for established reputation in research. Title D is a professorial fellowship. It's a fellowship given in recognition of senior academic position, usually involving heavy administrative burdens in the university. And Title E Fellowship is a fellowship for emeritus professors. It's a fellowship for longevity. So the only fellowship that George did not hold was a fellowship under Title C, which is the teaching fellowship in the college. George managed, and quite deliberately, to avoid taking on teaching responsibilities in the college. He really was totally devoted to his research, particularly in these early years, and He was elected to this fellowship under Title B, which gave him a great opportunity to focus on the development of the theory of turbulence. I've indicated some of the honors that George received. He was a Fellow of the Royal Society in 1957 at the very early age of 37. This was one of the much later honors. He was an emeritus member of the Academia Europaea in 1990, very much in recognition of his great contributions to the European Mechanics Society. Member of national academies of Sweden, Poland, France, Australia, USA twice. It was the Society of Arts and Sciences in 1959 and the US Academy of Sciences in 1994. He held honorary doctorates of the universities of Grenoble, Lyngby in Denmark, McGill in Canada, Michigan, Melbourne, Australia, which must have given him great pleasure because his roots remained in Australia. In a sense, he returned there very frequently throughout his life, and Stockholm, Sweden, 1995. He won the Adams Prize in 1951. That was really for the initial draft of his book on homogeneous turbulence, which was published in 1953. The Agostinelli Prize in Italy in 86. The Timoshenko Medal, the Royal Society Medal of the Royal Medal of the Royal Society in 1988, which I know gave him great pleasure. George was not one to look for honors of this kind, but when they came his way, he was indeed very, very pleased and honored. And particularly, above all, I think, the G.I. Taylor Medal of the U.S. Society of Engineering Sciences, because George's life was very much tied up. He had an enormous admiration for G.I. Taylor, and his development as a research scientist was really intimately related to George. He modeled himself in an important way on George and on G.I. Taylor and his whole style of research. Well, if I may backtrack a little, George was born on the 8th of March 1920 in Melbourne, Australia. He attended school in Melbourne and won a scholarship to Melbourne University, where he studied mathematics and physics, graduating at the precociously early age of 19 in 1939, just before World War II broke out. He had planned to study nuclear physics, but was advised that this subject had no future, and was guided instead to take up research during his MSc years 1939 to 41 in aerodynamics with the CSIR Division of Aeronautics. Throughout the war, he worked on a succession of practical problems, which were, as he said later, not of great fundamental interest, but which served to motivate him towards the study of turbulence, which he perceived not only as the most challenging aspect of fluid dynamics, but also as the most important in relation to aerodynamic applications. Actually, one of the problems that he worked on during the war seems to be of some historical interest. I was intrigued to find among his collected reprints one that is not actually on his list of publications. It's this unpublished ARD report from 1942, Note on the Aerial Flight of a Torpedo Bomb, marked secret. I hope it's still not still secret now. Concerned with the, otherwise I'm in trouble, concerned with the problem of designing aerodynamic attachments to a bomb for use at sea, which would make it hit the water at a prescribed angle and orientation and bounce along like a skipping, or as we say in Scotland where I come from, skipping stone. I haven't yet been able to check the precise chronology, but this must have been just about the time that Barnes Wallace in England was developing the same type of skipping bombs that would be used to such devastating effect against the German dams as immortalized in the film The Dam Busters. George never talked in later life about his involvement in these matters, except to say that his work in those days was of little importance and would not have merited publication. This skiffing stone problem is a beautiful problem for fluid dynamicists, incorporating all the difficulties of aerodynamic flight, free surface impact, boundary layer development, and so on. The sort of problem, I mean, when you think of it, the bouncing of a stone off the surface of water really needs some very clever argument to figure out why it does it and what the angle has to be and what the spin of the stone has to be and so on. Sort of problem that gives every excuse to spend hours on the beach in the interests of practical observation and experience. In the course of this work, George read the papers of G.I. Taylor from the 1930s on the statistical theory of turbulence and resolved that this was the subject he wanted to pursue as soon as the war ended. He wrote to G.I., offering his services as a research student, and G.I. agreed to take him on. At the same time, and most significantly, George persuaded his fellow Australian, Alan Townsend, who was working with him with the aeronautics division at the same time, to join him on this voyage of discovery. Alan Townsend had previously worked in electronics and knew nothing about fluid mechanics. I became aware in later years of George's great powers of coercion, of which this was perhaps a first manifestation. Alan Townsend revealed in a later essay, it's actually contained in the volume of JFM commemorating George's 70th birthday, published in 1990, that he had asked just two questions of George: what is turbulence, and who is G.I. Taylor? George's answers evidently convinced Alan that this was a good career move, and a partnership of great significance between George, the theoretician, and Alan, the experimentalist, was thus established. George married Wilma Raitz, also of Melbourne, in 1944, and in January 1945 they set off on an epic voyage to Cambridge. Nowadays, the journey can be accomplished, albeit with some discomfort, within 24 hours. Then, while war still raged across the globe, it took 10 weeks, via New Zealand, Panama, Jamaica, and New York, then in convoy of 90 ships across the Atlantic to Tilbury Docks in London, and thence to Cambridge. They arrived in springtime. The crocuses and daffodils were in bloom, as George has related in some of his later writings, and the place seemed like paradise after the rigors of the long journey, particularly, I suppose, the Atlantic crossing. At any rate, it was here in Cambridge that George and Wilma were destined to spend the rest of their lives. George was now just 25 years old. Alan Townsend came independently to Cambridge, and when he and George met G.I. and talked with him about the research that they would undertake, they were astonished to find that G.I. himself did not intend to work on turbulence, but rather on a range of problems, for example, the rise of large bubbles from underwater explosions and the blast wave from a point release of energy that he had encountered through war-related research activity. George and Alan were therefore left more or less free to determine their own program of research with guidance but minimal interference from GI, and they rose magnificently to this challenge. George Batchelor spent his first year in Cambridge searching the literature of turbulence in the library of the Cambridge Philosophical Society, what is now the Scientific Periodicals Library. There he made an amazing discovery. He came upon the English language editions of the 1941 issues of Docladdy, the Proceedings of the USSR Academy of Sciences, in which the seminal papers of Kolmogorov had been published. Amazing, because the Academy had been displaced from Moscow to Kazan in the foothills of the Ural Mountains in the face of the German advance from the west. Amazing, because it is hard to imagine how the Academy could have continued to produce an English language edition of Docladdy in the crisis situation then prevailing. Amazing, because it is hard to imagine how any mail, far less consignments of scientific journals, could find their way from the USSR to Cambridge during these dreadful years. But the fact is that George found these papers and immediately recognized their significance. In his lecture, 50 Years with Fluid Mechanics, that he gave at the 11th Australasian Fluid Mechanics Conference in 1991, I think it was, he said, "Like a prospector systematically going through a load of crushed rock, I suddenly came across two short articles, each of about 4 pages in length, whose quality was immediately clear." 4 pages was, I believe, the normal limit of length imposed by the USSR Academy for papers in Docladdy, a limit that perhaps suited Kolmogorov's minimalist style of presentation, but at the same time made it exceptionally difficult for others to understand the implications of his work. George did understand these implications and proceeded to a full and thorough discussion of the theory in a style that was to become his hallmark. The assumptions of the theory were set out with the utmost care, each hypothesis being subjected to critical discussion both as to its validity and its limitations. The resulting 27-page paper, and here is the first page of that paper, was published in Proceedings of the Cambridge Philosophical Society in 1947. Batchelor had previously, 1 year earlier, announced his findings at the 6th International Congress of Applied Mechanics, held remarkably in Paris in September 1946, when he drew attention to the parallel lines of inquiry of Onsager and of Heisenberg and von Weizsäcker. I say remarkably because it's not hard to imagine the conditions that must have been prevailing still in Paris so soon after the end of the war, and the conditions there, and how the French mathematicians managed to organize a congress which had been, in effect, delayed for reasons of the war, but to hold it in Paris in 1946 is altogether remarkable. But George's contribution to that congress is published in Nature. It's on his list of publications, Nature, 1946. But the full account was then published in this paper in 1947. There's a very interesting historical aspect to this. Both Heisenberg and von Weizsäcker were taken, together with other German theoretical physicists, to Britain at the end of the war and placed under house arrest in a large country house not far from Cambridge. G.I. Taylor visited them at their request, probably in August 1945. This was George's own memory of the situation. So very soon after they had arrived there, to discuss energy transfer in turbulent flow. I think what George said was that Heisenberg and von Weizsäcker were constrained in this country house. They were away from their labs, away from their scientific colleagues. All they could do was lie on their backs on the grass and look at the clouds scudding across the sky and think about the energy transfer, the turbulent processes. And so that's what got Heisenberg into turbulence. It was in subsequent discussions between GI and Batchelor that the link with the work of Kolmogorov was recognized. But as Batchelor said, and I quote, the clearest formulation of the ideas was that of Kolmogorov, and it was also more precise and more general. There can be little doubt that it was Batchelor's 1947 paper, this one, that effectively disseminated the Kolmogorov theory to the Western world. I understand, and Grisha Barenblatt may be able to confirm this, that it also served to make the theory comprehensible to turbulence researchers in the Soviet Union. The theory is now so well known that there's no need for me to go into details here. There's just one point, however, that does deserve mention. Batchelor draws attention particularly to Kolmogorov's derivation of what has now become known as the four-fifths law. And I show you where it is here. The four-fifths law for the third order structure function in isotropic turbulence. I think I need my pen to... Is there a pen that I could... Oh yeah, there. Thank you very much. Just to... I don't know if these are transferable, but probably just enough to indicate where the point is. Down here, the BDDR, which was Kolmogorov's notation, but Batchelor followed this notation in the 1947 paper. He used entirely the structure functions in three dimensions, and it's the cubic structure function, which is related to the second order structure. Oh, wonderful! Thank you very much. Related to the second order structure function from the what was then and still known as the von Karman-Haworth equation, and is equal in the inertial range of wave numbers to precisely minus 4/5 epsilon r. And this is very thoroughly discussed in this paper by Batchelor. It's a result that in some ways was lost, and I think the reason is the following. I believe that the derivation of this result provided by Batchelor still stands as the clearest derivation available anywhere. The result is not well known because for some inexplicable reason he did not himself regard it as sufficiently important to be worth including in his book, The Theory of Homogeneous Turbulence, published in 1953. It is noticeable that when a scientist publishes a research monograph on a subject, people tend to regard this as his last word, the sort of dernier mot on the subject, and to neglect his previous contributions, assuming these to be subsumed within the monograph. In the case of Batchelor's work, this is certainly a mistake, and it pays dividends still to go back to the original papers of the period 1946 to 1953. Now I want to turn to Batchelor and magnetohydrodynamics. Most participants, certainly those in the astrophysical turbulence program here, must be familiar with Batchelor's 1950 paper on the spontaneous magnetic field in a conducting liquid in turbulent motion. 1950. It's curious that Batchelor used the word liquid in the title. Throughout the paper, he uses the word fluid. And he obviously has in mind the astrophysical applications. He says that his interest in the problem was aroused at a symposium on The title was Problems of Motion in Gaseous Masses of Cosmical Dimensions, arranged jointly by the International Unions for Astronomy and for Applied Mechanics, and held in Paris also in August 1949. It's interesting to go back to the proceedings of that symposium to see what he said there. Again, this is from a paper that's not listed in his own personal list of publications. But that paper starts, and this is George speaking, "It is not a very enviable task to follow Dr. von Karman on this subject of turbulence. He explained things so very clearly, and he has touched on so many matters, that the list of things which I had to say is now torn to shreds by the crossings out I've had to make as his talk progressed. But there is one point on what ought to be called the pure turbulence theory which I should like to make. This point concerns the spectrum, and will be useful also for Dr. von Weizsäcker in his talk. After having made that point, I want to plunge straight into the subject that some of the speakers have lightly touched on and then hastily passed on from, namely, the interaction between the magnetic field and the turbulence. That will perhaps give us something to talk about. I shall be thinking aloud so that everything may be questioned." This is very typical George. It takes some courage to think aloud in an international gathering of this kind, and here was Batchelor at the age of 29, thinking aloud and indeed leading the debate in the presence of such giants as von Karman, von Neumann, who was there also, and von Weizsäcker. It was in this setting and in his 1950 paper that Batchelor developed the analogy between vorticity, omega, in a turbulent fluid and magnetic field, B, in a highly conducting fluid in turbulent motion. The analogy is one that has to be used with great care, because it is an imperfect one. Vorticity is constrained by the relation omega equals curl U to the velocity field U that convects it, whereas B is free of any such constraint. Nevertheless, some valid results do follow from the analogy, despite their slightly dubious foundation. In particular, the fact that in the ideal fluid limit, the magnetic flux through any material circuit is conserved, just as for an inviscid non-conducting fluid, the flux of vorticity through any material circuit is conserved, this remains obviously valid. Similarly, Volcker's 1958 theorem that the integral of A dot B dV, what later became known as magnetic helicity, is conserved for suitably chosen volumes V, has its counterpart for Euler flows of an ideal fluid. It was, in fact, through struggling to understand the physical significance of Volcker's invariant that I much later realized, and this was 1969, that this counterpart helicity, the integral of U dot omega dV, must be an invariant of the Euler equations. And this gains some significance from the fact that the Euler equations are nonlinear, containing within their structure the essential difficulties of the problem of turbulence, whereas the induction equation for B, for given U, is linear. The physical significance is that each helicity invariant can be interpreted in terms of linkage of closed material loops, vortex lines in one case, magnetic field lines in the other. And it is the imperfect yet powerful Batchelor analogy that allows the passage from one context to the other. It all seems transparently clear now, but before this physical understanding was acquired, it all seemed deeply mysterious. Well, Batchelor applied the analogy, and here's a page of this 1950 paper. He applied the analogy to the action of turbulence in a highly conducting cloud of ionized gas on a weak seed magnetic field. He argued that provided the magnetic diffusivity, eta, is less than nu, kinematic viscosity, then stretching of the field, which is the most, which is most efficient at the Kolmogorov scale, LV, down here on this diagram, that stretching of the magnetic field at this scale would lead to intensification of the magnetic field. and would intensify it actually on a time scale, the Kolmogorov time scale, until it reaches a level of equipartition of energy with the smallest scale or dissipation range ingredients of the turbulence. I think you can see the result in the equation 6.5 here. This is Batchelor's estimate for the equilibrium magnetic energy. He used H rather than B, and so you get this sort of factor. But it's essentially equipartition between magnetic energy and small-scale turbulent energy. In other words, the energy down here in the turbulent spectrum, not the energy of the what we describe as the energy-containing eddies. This sort of picture really was quite illuminating at that time, a spectral distribution of kinetic energy, an input of energy, transfer of energy through the inertial range, viscous dissipation, and here a certain transfer generation of magnetic field and joule heat loss. Well, that was the argument. I note that this estimate still survives, and I refer particularly to the review article of Russell Kulsrud in the Reviews of Astronomy and Astrophysics just last year, who writes, quote, "There is equipartition of the small-scale magnetic energy with the kinetic energy of the smallest eddy," unquote, which conforms with Batchelor's conclusion later in this paper. A steady state is reached when the magnetic field has as much energy as is contained in the small-scale components of the turbulence. Well, in fact, this conclusion, whether it's Batchelor's or Kulsrud's, it's still highly controversial. As we learned in discussions on Friday, just last week, it's still a matter of great controversy, just precisely what goes on in this situation. But whether or not the conclusion is concerning the small-scale field in a galactic cloud is correct, we have to admit that the argument on which it is based is really unsound. As I have indicated, it fails to take account of the fact that a far wider range of initial conditions is available to the magnetic field B than to the severely constrained vorticity field omega. The way to handle this evolved later, quite slowly, with the work of Parker in 1955, Braginski 1963, and most notably Steinbeck, Krauss, and Redler, the Potsdam group, in 1966, who developed the two-scale technique and the concepts of mean field electrodynamics. We now know that Batchelor's criterion, eta less than nu, for the growth of magnetic energy in turbulent flow is incorrect. Even when eta is much greater than nu, magnetic energy can grow on large scales if there's sufficient volume available to the turbulence, sufficient scale available, if the galaxy is sufficiently large, you might say, the critical requirement being that the turbulence lack reflectional symmetry. This is something that I myself got very much involved in from 1969 onwards. And yet, as Russell Kulsrud has argued, and as we heard again from Stephen Cowley here just last Friday, arguments of the type advanced 50 years ago by Batchelor are still highly relevant to considerations of small-scale field and of saturation mechanisms. I'd now like to make some comments on George Batchelor as a research supervisor. I attended some of Batchelor's lectures in Cambridge in 1957-58 and decided at the end of that year that, partly because I didn't know the first thing about it, I wanted to study turbulence. One thing I've discovered since is that in order to be a success in turbulence, it's important to have a second theme to fall back on when the going gets tough. My second theme was magnetohydrodynamics. I visited George in his office in the old Cavendish laboratory. This was just before the foundation of the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics. I remember my impression of him then, a tall, thin man with angular features. If he'd been any other shape, he would not have fitted the office, which was also tall and thin, and densely lined with shelves of books and periodicals and papers. There was just room for a very small but very essential blackboard on one wall. This, I remind you, was just 2 years after George had founded the Journal of Fluid Mechanics, and the flood of papers to the journal was already beginning. developing and converging on this small office in the old Cavendish. It was also 1 year after George's election as Fellow of the Royal Society. George set me to work on the problem of the transfer of heat from particles suspended in air in turbulent motion. I'm afraid I didn't stick with that problem for very long because I was keen to work on MHD. I should say that George himself returned to the problem of transfer. It wasn't transfer of heat, but transfer of mass from an evaporating particle, which turned out to be much more interesting. And George returned to that problem himself around 1980. But anyway, George had given me preprints of two papers. It was just about that time. And I was fortunate to have preprints of them. They were published in 1959, and this was still 1958. And you see G.K. Batchelor, Cavendish Laboratory, University of Cambridge, June 1958. Well, DAMTP was founded from, October 1959. And this was one of the two papers that George gave me when I started research, concerned with the spectrum of a passive scalar field, like temperature, in a turbulent flow. And it was here that I saw my opportunity. Why not apply the same technique that George had applied in this context to the problem of a passive vector field, i.e. to a weak magnetic field in a turbulent fluid of high conductivity? I'm glad to say that George gave me every encouragement to work on this problem, which of course had obvious connections with his earlier 1950 paper on the vorticity magnetic field analogy. George gave me enormous moral and intellectual support during these early years of research, and I shall always feel deeply grateful to him. I believe that his other research students, of whom there were many, invariably found that behind his rather severe, perhaps austere, exterior, there was a very real interest and concern in the progress of his students. I recall that about once a month I would write an account of my investigations, running to perhaps 10 pages, and submit this with some trepidation to George. Within a day it would come back to me, heavily annotated, with marginal comments, which usually led to abandonment of about 90% of the inadequately argued ideas that the paper contained. But the important thing was that even 10% might survive this mauling. And on this 10%, George would give every encouragement and generous suggestions as to what should be tried next. The technique that George had used on the passive scalar problem, in the case of large Prandtl number, that was nu large compared with the molecular diffusivity kappa, was to consider the action of a uniform strain field, called U alpha X beta Y gamma Z, on a single Fourier component of the theta field, the theta being the scalar field, this being a reasonable approximation to U on scales small compared with the Kolmogorov scale. The argument led to the k to the minus 1 spectrum for theta. Here again is a typical Batchelor diagram showing this time the theta spectrum on a log-log plot, the kinetic energy spectrum with its minus 5/3 range, and a similar minus 5/3 for gamma of n, n he used for wave number, gamma the spectrum of the theta field, minus 5/3 range, then a conduction cutoff, and a range that Batchelor discovered, the minus 1 slope, a rather interesting slope for the spectrum, because of course if you integrate the spectrum over this range, you get a divergence as this wave number, which depends on molecular diffusivity, goes to infinity. That is sort of divergent, logarithmic divergence was something that Batchelor discussed very thoroughly in the paper. Well, it seemed natural that I should do the same sort of analysis for magnetic field under the corresponding assumption that magnetic diffusivity is small compared with kinematic viscosity. One can follow one Fourier component of B, magnetic field, under the action of uniform straining without difficulty. The problem comes with summing over all Fourier components when it appears that in general the sum diverges as time t goes to infinity. In other words, the magnetic energy increases without limit in spite of the ever-accelerating action of magnetic diffusivity, accelerating because length scales are decreasing. A similar behavior occurs for mean square vorticity when a random vorticity field is subjected to uniform strain in the context of rapid distortion theory. This was something that had been discovered by Anthony Pearson, published also in 1959 in JFM. It thus became clear that the only way to achieve saturation of the magnetic field was to include the back reaction of the Lorentz force on the velocity field. To fix ideas, I considered a localized blob of magnetic field. I just show you the sort of concept here. A localized blob of magnetic field which is flattened to pancake form by a strain field. This was compressive strain when two of the rates of strain were positive. And I did find one configuration that provided a balance, this sort of pancake structure that provided a balance between the inward tension of the magnetic field and the disruptive viscous stress of the strain field. And as could in fact be anticipated on dimensional grounds, if such structures are more or less space-filling, then the equilibrium magnetic energy is given by the Batchelor estimate. It's dimensional because this straining is really down at the Kolmogorov scale, so it can only depend on the parameters epsilon and nu. So I recovered the Batchelor estimate, which was quite satisfactory given that I was a research student of Batchelor, and if I'd found anything else, there was going to be some trouble. Well, this work was duly published, but I must say that the last thing I expected was that anyone would actually refer to it, and this at least turned out to be correct, whatever else was correct or incorrect in the paper. The great weakness of the work in the galactic context was that in the normal spirit of turbulence research, the fluid had been assumed incompressible, whereas all the evidence points to the fact that galactic turbulence is highly supersonic. A further weakness lay in the assumption of isolated blobs of field, whereas in reality the field is much more likely to be space-filling, each line of force wandering chaotically throughout the medium. It might be worth going back to this type of analysis now, making weaker assumptions about both the medium and the field, and I believe that this could still be of great interest. At the other limit, eta much greater than nu, Batchelor's 1950 criterion had indicated that a random field would not survive. This was, even at that time, controversial. Biermann and Schluter in 1951 had argued for an entirely different criterion, but I was under Batchelor's influence. It nevertheless made sense to consider what happens if a weak B field, magnetic field, is maintained at large scales by some agency. Turbulence then scrambles this field, and we may seek to determine the spectrum of the field fluctuations. Of course, we know now that large-scale field may be generated by an alpha effect. If, as is usually the case in rotating convecting systems, the turbulence has helicity. So calculation of the spectrum of the fluctuating field, which may be much stronger than the mean field, is still a very active issue. I was here guided by the paper, the second paper of 1959, Batchelor, Howells and Townsend. I think everyone knows who Batchelor was and everyone knows who Townsend was, but very few people know who Howells was. He's a very interesting character. He wrote one or two other papers. He was a fellow of Trinity at that time. Wrote an interesting paper which actually foreshadowed some of the ideas on renormalization group in turbulence. But at the end of his period as a Title A fellow of Trinity, he went off back to Australia to become a Jesuit priest. He more or less retired from research in science, although in fact he reappeared again about 30 years later in DAMTP, and it appeared that he was still actually thinking about the problem. Anyway, that was Howell. The same style of argument that Batchelor, Howells and Townsend use, and again I show the picture of the spectra from that paper. See, in that situation you have a minus 5/3 spectrum for E, and the conduction cutoff is now at a lower wave number. So you have minus 5/3, and there is a range identified in this paper which gives a spectrum with an interesting slope, minus 17/3. So again, I jumped on this possibility and worked out the corresponding things for magnetic field. I think time won't allow me to describe the detail. Well, I'll just show you the corresponding pictures. They're in the first paper that I published, which was in 1961, very much under George's inspiration and influence. And this is in JFM, and it shows a minus 11/3 range for magnetic field, from which one can, and a plus one-third range for magnetic field, because the field gets more and more intensified. This is when you have very weak source of field at large length scales, distortion of field in a reasonably strong conducting situation, and the fluctuation energy is a factor of order magnetic Reynolds number, which can be large, times the input energy. And then I also considered what happens if these energies, if this magnetic energy becomes so large that the Lorentz force reacts back on the turbulent spectrum. Again, these are the sort of problems that I'm very interested to find are still at the center of discussions here. Now, I come to the meeting in Marseille, 1961, and I say this is near the end of my lecture because for various reasons, not only because time will run out. While I was still a research student, George invited me to participate in a conference which was to be held in August in Marseille of that year, 1961, and of which he was one of the main organizers. I believe that he really was the motive force behind this meeting. It turned out to be a most remarkable event. Kolmogorov himself was there, together with Obukhov and Miliontshikov, who had first proposed the zero-fourth cumulance closure scheme in which so much work and hope had been invested during the 1950s. Von Karman was there, and G.I. Taylor was there, the great father figures of pre-war research in turbulence. And the place was humming with all the current stars of the subject. Stan Corson, John Lumley, Philip Safman, who I'm delighted to see is with us today from Caltech, Bob Craiknon, Ian Proudman, and George Batchelor himself, among many others. It was at this meeting that I first met Ed Spiegel, who was here last week. Here is George speaking at the end of his opening lecture in the session on homogeneous turbulence, 1961, and I think he would still say similar things if he were among us today. He says, speaking very broadly, the basic dynamical problem has been in the doldrums to some extent during the last 10 years and has been in need of good ideas and new lines of approach. Formal mathematical investigations have produced remarkably little of value. Successful theoretical work has more often taken the form of simple deductions from an assumed plausible physical model of a limited aspect of the flow. He was obviously thinking of the Kolmogorov theory. Work on the dynamics of the energy-containing eddies has more or less run its course for the reasons I have mentioned. A number of general procedures for calculation of various dynamical aspects of homogeneous turbulence have been devised, but none of them impresses me as being likely either to advance our understanding of turbulence or to achieve results on which we can place reliance. I think he was thinking of the Craiknon theory, which he had great difficulty in understanding. That is quite new at that time. The universal similarity theory of the small-scale components of the motion stand out in this rather grey picture as a valuable contribution, of which an increasing number of applications is being made, especially in problems involving convection and diffusion of scalar or vector properties of the fluid. There is a need for two kinds of further work in connection with this theory. First, for some mathematical proofs of some of the notions of the theory, such as the increasing degree of disorder accompanying transfer of energy to larger wave numbers. That was a side reference to intermittency. And second, for measurement of the mean values of third and fourth order powers, of velocity derivatives at very high Reynolds number, and so on. Just one or two other points. Well, one of the first highlights of this Marseille meeting, do I have 5 minutes more? Okay. Was when Bob Stewart presented results of the measurements of ocean spectra in the tidal channel between Vancouver Island and mainland Canada, just up the coast from here. These were the first convincing measurements showing several decades of a K to the minus 5/3 spectrum and provided convincing support for Kolmogorov's theory, which had been published 20 years before. But then Kolmogorov himself got up to give his lecture, which I recall was in the sort of French that was as incomprehensible to the French themselves as to the most of the other participants. However, the gist of the lecture was clear. He said that quite soon after the publication of the two 1941 papers, Landau had pointed out to him a defect in the theory, namely that where the local value of epsilon is larger, there the cascade will proceed more vigorously and an increasingly intermittent distribution of epsilon as a function of x and t is therefore to be expected. Arguing for a log-normal probability distribution for epsilon, a suggestion put forward by Obuldoff, Kolmogorov showed that the exponent minus 5/3 should be changed slightly and that higher order statistical quantities would be more strongly affected by the intermittency. I'll show you the sort of picture that is now, we're now quite familiar with in this sort of context. The Kolmogorov 41 theories give a straight line for structure function exponents as a function of order. Kolmogorov 61 log normal gives a parabola, the actual measurements of spectra, which become increasingly subject to uncertainty as n increases, go somewhere, in fact, between these two. This actually must, in fact, have been no real surprise to George, because it was he and Townsend who had remarked on the phenomenon of intermittency of the distribution of vorticity in their 1949 paper, The Nature of Turbulent Motion at Large Wave Number, 1949. They had noticed the puzzling increase of flatness factor, or kurtosis as it's often called, of velocity derivatives with increasing Reynolds number, a behavior that is inconsistent with the original Kolmogorov theory. Here's the essential picture from the 49 paper of Batchelor and Townsend, which shows this is these are flatness factors, or kurtosis, and this is increasing Reynolds number, and for each value of n you see a systematic increase in the kurtosis, which is inconsistent with Kolmogorov 1941. Of course, it's always possible, and perhaps they believe that if you go to sufficiently high Reynolds number, these things will asymptote to constants, but that was all the evidence that they had at that time. They interpreted this in terms of a tendency to form, quote, isolated regions of concentrated vorticity, unquote. And it's interesting to note that much of the research on turbulence over the last decade has been devoted to identifying such concentrated vorticity regions, both in experimental and in numerical simulations. Townsend himself thought in terms of a random distribution of vortex tubes and sheets, a paper published in 1951 in a theory for the dissipative structures of turbulence described in Batchelor's 1953 book. I still see that 1961 Marseille meeting as a watershed for research in turbulence. The very foundations of the subject were shaken by Kolmogorov's presentation, and the new approaches, particularly Kraichmann's direct interaction approximation, were of such mathematical complexity that it was really difficult to retain that essential link between mathematical description and physical understanding, which is essential for real progress. In fact, George took a conscious personal decision after that meeting to give up turbulence research. There were other major demands on his time and energy, notably the editorship of JFM and the building up of the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics, which had been established under his leadership in 1959. Moreover, he focused in the 1960s on the writing of his great textbook, An Introduction to Fluid Dynamics, published in 1967. He did, I'm very nearly finished, he did occasionally return to turbulence in later years, and each paper that he published was of great significance. I note particularly his 1969 paper, Computation of the Energy Spectrum, in homogeneous two-dimensional turbulence. Two-dimensional turbulence. The seeds of which had been sown, I believe, at the Marseille meeting, because the computational work reported in that paper had been carried out by George's research student, Roger Bray, during the period 1961 to 1964. It was in this period that George developed the concept of an entropy or mean square vorticity cascade, something that Craiknon had also put forward in 1967. And he also noted the flow of energy to larger scales, although he cannot be accused of introducing the controversial term inverse cascade. In promoting one of the first direct numerical simulations of turbulence, albeit two-dimensional, this was on the old Cambridge computer, EDSAC 2, Batchelor showed typical foresight in recognizing the way that research in turbulence was likely to develop in the future. It is actually a beautiful paper, which still deserves close study. Finally, I want to mention the much later paper, Batchelor, Canuto and Chasnov, 1992. Homogeneous buoyancy-generated turbulence. George's last paper in turbulence, although he wrote several more in the field of microhydrodynamics, his main area of research, since 1970. This paper considers the nature of the turbulence that is generated by a given random distribution of buoyancy in a fluid. Right now, I'm working on just this sort of model for the turbulent or pseudo-turbulent flow in the liquid core of the Earth, where we believe that the turbulence is driven by by the same kind of buoyancy-driven mechanism, although influenced very strongly by Coriolis and magnetic effects. It gives me great pleasure and satisfaction, once again, as so often in the past, to be following in the footsteps of a great master. Thank you. Howells, yes. Yes. Yes.
Could you comment on what type of working relationship did George have with G.I. Taylor, aside from admiration and inspiration?
Well, he says that G.I., I mean, he was always a very good sounding board, obviously, for both Batchelor and Townsend on turbulence, but G.I., and it's obvious from his own publications that he was off in every other direction from 1946 onwards. G.I. published any papers on turbulence, but he did come to that meeting. Obviously, George coerced him to come to the Marseille meeting. And so, gee, it was a wonderful meeting. Philip will remember how von Karman would disrupt the proceedings by arriving 10 minutes late for each lecture, and he would slowly come down the aisle shaking hands with everybody, and G.I. at the end in the front row, a sort of warm embrace, and whoever was lecturing just had to wait until this performance was over. It was wonderful. But I don't know that, I mean, George, yes, he did. He edited G.I.'s works. He obviously worked on the papers, read them, studied them, and developed this deep, deep admiration for G.I. and wrote his biography in one of his last works in the 1990s. I don't really know. I mean, I knew G.I. At Trinity College in the 1960s. He was an extremely genial man. I really don't know whether there was more than that in the professional interaction between G.I. and George.
Can you say a few more words about the
Well, this paper by Howells is worth looking at. I'm sorry I can't give you the exact reference. It's a very short paper, Journal of Fluid Mechanics, and it's about 1960. And of course, Howells did not use the word renormalization group, but it was applied to the scalar field problem, and it was following on Batchelor's paper, and he considered a scalar field, and it was a situation where you consider the action small eddies, then larger, then larger, then larger, and you average successively over different scales. And he developed an differential equation for the effective diffusivity as a function of wave number. Now, that really is a concept that was later developed as the concept of renormalization. Well, as I say, it can't have been a surprise, and now I'm quite puzzled by... Batchelor's paper of 49 was a precursor. Yes, that's right, and in a way, if Batchelor and Townsend, when they made this discovery in 1949 from measurements, if they'd stuck their necks out then and said there is something wrong with Kolmogorov's theory, then they'd have been even more famous than they are now. They didn't do that. I think Batchelor was already, as we all are, very emotionally attached to the simplicity and the beauty of the original Kolmogorov theory. And the last thing he wanted to do was to abandon that. But of course, after 1961, we knew there was something wrong with it. Something had to be done. But it's always better if you're out in mid-ocean to have, say, a leaky raft to hold on to, something to hold on to, than nothing at all. I think that's the way we must look at it. It was. Yes, it was a golden era. And I remember particularly having wonderful discussions with Philip around that time, 59, 60, on this problem of magnetohydrodynamic turbulence. Yes, yes, that's right. I came to your part three lectures, yes.